Well, Dr. Robin Pelkov sent me a little message about a study that she had found. Using the common pokeweed, which is what we're talking about as part of the formula from Hoxie, on childhood leukemia cases, 15 out of 18 kids went into remission taking a substance from pokeweed. Amazing, isn't it? We'll be back in a moment with Kenny Ossible and more on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with Kenny Ossible. Kenny, that was an incredible mini study about pokeweed, wasn't it?
That's fascinating, George. Good for you.
Well, good for Robin Falco for letting us know, huh?
You bet. That's great.
But a lot of practitioners who will do this are afraid of getting raided, arrested, aren't they?
You know, it's really terrorism. I mean, it's really at that level. And it's interesting because the judge, one of the federal judges who ruled in Hoxie's favor, said, you pays your money, you takes your choice. You know, if you think one side is best, go to them. If you think the other is best, go to them. And, you know, over as of several years ago, over two-thirds of cancer patients were also using an alternative therapy. And in most of those cases, they were fearful to even tell their doctor because they knew they would just be put down and dismissed or expelled. I mean, I've heard stories from patients who said, when I told my doctor I was using an alternative treatment, he refused to see me anymore. So, you know, this is the kind of thing that goes on, and it's going to take a mass political movement in this country to get something to change here. And we also have a medical system that's collapsing of its own weight and that is financially completely unsustainable. And the truth about a lot of the alternative therapies is they're relatively safe and they're much, much cheaper, you know, and people feel good about doing them, which is not insignificant.
No, not at all. Let's talk about some other areas, Kenny, that you've been doing some work in as well. You work with a lot of Native Americans. Tell me about that.
Yeah, you know, actually, George, if I may, there's one, I'd like to just sort of segue one last thing about Hoxie.
Sure.
Yeah. When I was finishing the book, this giant study came out of Scandinavia that was a meta study of multiple studies all aggregated together, and it had been funded by the biotechnology industry. They wanted to prove essentially that cancer was a genetic disease and therefore a genetic, you know, biotech cure would be worth really pursuing in a big way. And they studied twins because they provide a really, really good control group, you know, when you've got two people that are that similar genetically. And what they found was genetic causes of cancer account for at most 10 to 30% of cancers. In other words, 70 to 90% of cancers are caused directly by exposure in the environment or in your workplace, right, to carcinogens. So when we talk about curing cancer, I mean, obviously you want to try to cure it when people have it, but the real ticket here is prevention. You know, 70 to 90% of cancer is preventable if we change how we live, and a lot of that has to do with chemicals and, you know, all the rest of the stuff that we're exposing ourselves to, the whole industrial metabolism. So that was my big takeaway, in a way, from the whole Hoxie story. And I'd been very concerned about the environment and aware of all the, you know, problems that we were creating. But that was kind of the tipping point for me of realizing, you know, if you really want to make a difference in cancer, the thing to do is clean up the environment. And that was a big, that was when I went on to found the company Seeds of Change, and then a year later, the Bioneers Conference. And there's one really interesting story that's a good bridge here, because I think I mentioned him to you last time, but one of my favorite Bioneers, which is like a biological pioneer, somebody who's looked to nature for nature's solutions, basically. You know, nature has 3.8 billion years of R&D under her belt. And
right.
what's here is what works. You know, there are no recalls in nature. Either you make it or you don't, you know. So, but anyway, his name is Paul Stamets, and he lives up in Washington State in the old growth, you know, country up there, Pacific Northwest. And he's a mycologist who studies mushrooms and fungi. And, you know, we know quite a bit about fungi, but relatively very little considering how important they are. We've only studied 75,000 species out of what we estimate to be a minimum of a million, just to give you a sense of how little we actually know. But nothing would ever decay without mushrooms and bacteria. Nature, you know, recycles everything, right? And so this is what breaks down the carbon cycle, or you know, fungi and microbes. And so Paul, you know, in Asia, it's a mycophilic culture. They love and revere mushrooms. Here in the States, it's more mycophobic. People are really kind of frightened of mushrooms. But what he found was that they have profound, you know, impacts on human health. And the most recent development, something that just happened in the last year or so, was that Paul's elderly 80-something-year-old mother got breast cancer. I think it was breast cancer, but she was stage 4 breast cancer, and was given months to live by the doctors. And Paul finally convinced her to try some of his mushrooms, one in particular that's called turkey tail. Not unknown, but not well known, you know. And he also gave her another supplement that his company produces called My Community. That's a whole combination of a bunch of different very potent mushrooms. Well, she made a complete and total recovery from, you know, stage 4 breast cancer, and is happy and well and living. And so what Paul began years and years ago was an inquiry saying, if these things are such powerful medicines in our bodies, could they also be medicines for the earth? What are they actually doing in a bigger sense in the ecology? Yeah, we know they break down, you know, all kinds of, you know, materials to recycle them in the carbon cycle. So he got a chance to test his theory. There was a big spill of diesel oil not far from where his farm was, and the Washington State Department of the Environment called in a whole bunch of these bioremediation companies to have at it and see if they could, you know, decontaminate this diesel dirt, basically. And they were given, you know, a sort of a cell of dirt, like 20 feet by 40 feet to work with, and all allowed to come in and do whatever they wanted to do. And most of the others were, you know, chemical related or enzymes. And Paul came in to his little cell of dirt, and he inoculated it with the spore from oyster mushrooms. Now, I'm sure you've probably eaten oyster mushrooms or bought them at the farm.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, they're a choice. They're $16 a pound. They're very tasty and very, very nutritious. So everybody, you know, does their thing, and then they covered these cells of dirt up with tarps, and they came back about 6 weeks later. And one by one, they're ripping these tarps off, and the stench of hydrocarbons is completely overwhelming. I mean, it really stinks of oil, right? And if the stuff is working at all, it had to be very, very slow. And then they get to Paul's.
Yeah, Kenny, hold on for a second. Your phone's starting to break up on me, and I want to see if I can fix it here. If not, I'm going to have Tom call you back. But go ahead. Does that sound a little better to you?
Yeah, it's fine for me.
Nope. It's not working on my end here. And I tell you what, we're gonna call you back. So you hang up, and Tom will call you right back, and we'll try to get you a better connection there, because you started off like gangbusters, and then it got a little more crackly as it went down. So we'll see if we can pick up Kenny, and I hope we do. He's in Hawaii, and we should be able to connect with a better line there. But he was really starting to crack up like crazy. You know, when I had him on about 5 years ago, we were also talking about, at the time, his brand new documentary that he did on the life and the work of Harry Hoxsey. And I have been fascinated with this story for years, primarily ever since I talked to Kenny back in 2007, and that's when he was on. And it's just an incredible story. But, you know, what's so important is, you know, you on one hand, you understand government wants to make sure that you don't get hit with fraud and people who are making claims to things that just don't work, to take advantage of you, to make money from you, to hurt you. On the other hand, I can see the political ramifications of Big Pharma not wanting these kinds of companies, including, of course, you know, like Hoxsey's clinic, to do whatever they have to do. So let's go back to you, Kenny, and see how you are, and continue. You're back
okay,
with us.
Very good. Can you hear me okay?
Yep, I sure can. You were just breaking up a little bit there at the end.
No problem. So anyway, Paul Stamets, you know, he tears this tarpaulin off of his cell of diesel contaminated dirt, and it is completely blanketed with oyster mushrooms, some of them a foot in diameter, literally. And so they tested the soil, and they tested the flesh of the mushrooms, and they found essentially no diesel fuel left at all. The mushroom had treated it as food and digested it. That was it. It metabolized it and completely detoxified it. And that would be, you know, significant enough, but according to Paul, this is when the real magic started to kick in. Because over the coming days and weeks, you know, the mushrooms started to decay. Maggots and worms came in. Birds flew in to eat the worms and maggots, and they carried seeds in their feathers. And within a matter of weeks, this dead diesel dirt turned into an oasis of life. And that's what environmental restoration looks like in fast forward when you know what you're doing.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Okay, so let's get into some of the things that are out there right now. Why do you think, you know, as I was saying, as we were hooking you back up, on one hand, I can see government trying to protect people, right? You know, keep them from fraudulent people. People are trying to make money. People are trying to sell lousy products. I, for example, wouldn't take supplements from China because God knows what's in that stuff. You know, I mean, look at the stuff that they put in baby food and everything else, lead and all this stuff. So I can understand them trying to tighten the reins on some people. But on the other hand, Kenny, I'm convinced that Big Pharma doesn't want natural remedies for anything because they don't make money on that. And that government might be culpable and part of that in order to prevent people from using natural supplements to boost their immune system. So where do you look at? I mean, it's on one hand, you can say, well, they want to protect us. On the other hand, you think they do not. Where does the average person fit here?
Yeah, well, that's the big, you know, question. It's really the rhinoceros in the room is really corporate power. I mean, from my perspective, when people blame government, I think that it's somewhat misplaced because government has largely been taken over by corporations. You know, the most recent developments being, of course, with Citizens United and corporations being given, quote, free speech, which is so expensive none of us can afford it anymore. And, you know, that ruling was just upheld in Montana, where the Supreme Court overrode the state of Montana along with 21 other states that have passed laws that essentially limit corporate rights and revoke corporate constitutional rights. And that's pretty much the cutting edge of where the real battle is, because as long as you have Big Pharma calling the shots in Washington, I mean, they own government to speak of. You know, Dick Durbin, the senator, when during the banking crisis, he said, frankly, banks own the place. They own Washington, D.C., you know. So that's one of the other people in the Bioneers Network whose work I have just tremendous admiration for, who's been working in, you know, to rebuild democracy, which is what this boils down to. And that's the question of where people come in, because what you find is, you know, just as we're talking about Hoxie or whether it's all kinds of alternative technologies that are shelved, you know, for whatever reasons, that corporations are able to override communities and people pretty much at will. And it built, you know, had 100 years to perfect the legal and political structure to do that.
Well, and they will, won't they, in a heartbeat.
They will and they are. And this guy that I mentioned, Tom Lindsay, he's a public interest attorney originally from Pennsylvania, and he's formed a public interest law firm. You know, there's only 200 pro bono public interest lawyers left in the whole country anymore, George, if you can wrap your mind around that. And so they're called the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. And they started getting all these calls from, you know, they used to work with a lot of environmental groups trying to stop all the bad stuff from happening. And then they started getting all these calls from city governments in western Pennsylvania, which is extremely conservative country. I mean, definitely, you know, red politically. And what was happening was agribusiness had targeted western Pennsylvania to come in and do all these giant factory farms. And, you know, for example, in North Carolina, the hogs there, it's one of the biggest hog-producing states, produce more fecal waste than all the citizens of New York and California combined.
Oh, my God.
Combined, right? And there's no regulation to speak of. They just dump the stuff in ponds and run it into the waterways, into the aquifers. And so Western Pennsylvania, which has a big tradition of family farms, didn't want to do this. You know, they said, thanks, but no thanks. We'll pass. And Tom said, basically, the only thing that environmental regulations regulate is environmentalists. It's not a matter of if they can do it, but how slowly or how fast, you know, they can pollute. And so he said, what you really need to do is rewrite your ordinances. And they wrote something called the Corporate Rights Elimination Ordinance, which they started passing in all these communities in western Pennsylvania. There's now hundreds of them, actually, that have passed this. And they've simply outright banned corporate factory farming. And so far, not one single large-scale corporate factory farm has been built for years now. So that's where the struggle goes. And then Tom went on from there because, as you may know, there's 43 states that have home rule provisions, which allows for a certain degree of sovereignty at the local level,
right,
particularly for cities, for municipalities. And so what they started doing was writing municipal constitutions, which revoke corporate constitutional rights and elevate the rights of people and communities to make their own decisions about a sustainable future or whatever kind of future they want to have. And so this is happening all over the country now. They do something called democracy schools, where they come in and train citizens. I've done it three times. I got so much out of it. It's just a phenomenal tool. And I've got a new book coming out, by the way, this fall in August, called Dreaming the Future, Reimagining Civilization in the Age of Nature. And I've got a whole chapter in there on Tom Lindsay and this work, because it's one of the few things that's actually being successful. And obviously, the corporations are not going to take it lying down. There's a fierce counter-reaction every time communities stand up and say no. You just
right.
say no. But it's ultimately a choice that we're all going to have to make in this country as to whether we have a democracy or a, you know, corporate plutocracy or a kleptocracy. They'll take anything they can get their hands on, you know.
If you had cancer, God forbid, or somebody in your family had cancer, what would you do right now?
Well, it somewhat depends on the type of cancer, but in general, I would go the alternative route first. You know, I should say flat out, I know people and I have friends who have been cured by conventional cancer treatments. So everything has a place. It's a question, you know, of what's right for you, which I think is between you and your doctor or healer, or, you know, between you and being informed. You know, I think you should make an informed decision and really do the research. But generally, you know, not to overgeneralize, but I would generally go an alternative route first. I mean, the conventional treatment that makes the most sense in a lot of cases is surgery, particularly if it's a very large tumor. You may just want to get it out, and there's good reasons to do that. Radiation is very questionable, and chemotherapy is effective only in most, at most in 5% of cancers, and mostly the rarer forms like childhood cancers, leukemia and Hodgkin's lymphoma and stuff like that. So anyway, that I would definitely consider Hoxie myself. There's an excellent treatment in New York by Dr. Nick Gonzalez that's a metabolic regimen that uses a lot of enzymes and a very heavy nutritional regimen.
Have you heard of the work of Tullio Simonucci?
No, I have not.
He is using baking soda, injecting it, pumping it directly into the cancer, and he says it's incredible that he's got incredible results there.
How interesting.
Yeah.
Well, all these things should be studied. You know, there's other very important treatments, because in general, what you want to do is build your immunity, because we're all, you know, just bathed in toxins in this world that we all live in. I mean, I live fairly well in a relatively clean place, and I try to eat mostly organic food, and I don't eat, you know, industrial, commercial, I mean, factory farm meat. I do eat meat, but it's organic and local and stuff like that. But, you know, you do the best you can. But one of the treatments that I found very helpful, I don't know if you've run into it, is called ultraviolet blood treatments.
I've heard of that.
Yeah, it's quite profound. But basically, you know, it's an IV. They put a needle in your arm and they draw blood out through a box that emits infrared light that kills viruses and pathogens. And then it goes into a syringe that's filled with ozone. And then they basically drip, you know, you can do an IV drip that goes back into your body going through this ultraviolet light and then is very heavily oxygenated. And the single most important medical fact or scientific fact about cancer is that it's an anaerobic disease. It flourishes only in the absence of oxygen. So flooding your body with oxygen is a really, really good thing to do. And I just do this for health maintenance, you know, and it's been... I haven't been sick in several years, and I live a pretty high-stress lifestyle. So give thanks. I mean, I take nothing for granted, but...
Let's talk about the future when we come right back, Kenny. And then next hour, we'll take phone calls and stories on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, I'm looking for 5,000 new Facebook followers tonight. That's all you have to do is go to our website and click the Facebook icon and like us there, and off you go. I'm looking for 5,000 of you. Let's start that right now. We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you and our special guest, Kenny Ossabel. We'll take phone calls with Kenny next hour. Kenny, what's the future hold? Give me your thoughts over the next 5-10 years.
Yeah, sure. You know, what I'd love to do is just finish up, too, on the Paul Stamets, and that's a good lead into some of what I think the future holds. Can I do that?
Yeah.
Yeah, so after Paul cleaned up this contaminated soil, he went on to do a number of other things with his mushrooms and mycelia. They're able to actually stop E. coli bacteria cold in the field with a mushroom that eats E. coli bacteria. But the Pentagon, the Department of Defense, heard about his work, and they called Paul up. And, you know, he's kind of an old hippie, and they gave him security clearance and the whole deal. And the problem they're dealing with is chemical weapons. A lot of these weapons, which we have the biggest stockpile in the world here in the U.S., many of them not far from where I live in Colorado and Utah, they're degrading after decades, and there's no good way to get rid of them. And obviously, most communities don't want them incinerated in their backyard because it goes into the air. And so they asked Paul if any of his mushrooms could work. So he did a classic blinded experiment where he sent them 28 different samples numbered 1 through 28 and told them to have at it. And it was sarin, which is a, you know, a nerve gas, very right up there with plutonium, really lethal. And he kind of forgot about all this. And 6 months later, he gets a call back from the Department of Defense. Two of his mushrooms had worked, completely decommissioning sarin, you know. And they went on and tested it against VX nerve gas and these other compounds that are really hard to destroy and last forever. And so that's what happened. These mushrooms were actually able to take some of the worst toxins on the planet and, you know, digest them, decontaminate them completely. Paul ended up telling the Defense Department that he found these mushrooms in the Pacific Northwest in the old-growth redwoods up there, and he said, protecting our national forests is really a matter of national defense, you know? But I think one of the most interesting things happening, and a lot of what the inspiration was for Bioneers, was around this field that now has a name called biomimicry. It's a design science of innovation inspired by nature, that essentially nature has figured out how to do everything we want to do, with, but without mining the past or polluting, you know, the present or mortgaging the future. And so one of my other favorite biomimic inventors is a guy named Jay Harman, who grew up in Australia and lived by the ocean and loved to watch the sea and got very interested in the movements of water. Mm-hmm. And there's nature has a favorite form, which is the spiral, right? Which is also the Fibonacci sequence, the mathematical kind of image of perfection, you know, the golden mean. It's been studied by Da Vinci and Pythagoras and a lot of the greats down through the ages. And it's, you know, when you see your water go down a bathtub drain, that spiral vortex, that's the path of least resistance in nature. And it's the way the blood flows through your veins. It's how air travels in your lungs. It's how plants unfurl themselves. It's the shape of galaxies. It's everywhere. It's also one of the ancient mystical symbols among most native peoples and many traditional cultures, you know, the spiral. So what Jay realized was that nobody had ever applied the spiral to design before, any kind of design. And the way that nature works is not to blast things with huge amounts of energy. Nature sips energy rather than guzzles it. It does it by form and function. So, for example, Jay applied his spiral design to propellers and motors, which use up a huge amount of the planet's energy, something like 60%. And he started with boats, and he designed something called an impeller instead of a propeller, and then went on to do fans. You know, the old original Macs had 16 fans in them to try to cool them. I mean, it's, you know, industrial mixing, on and on. And these motors use about 60% of the energy, and they don't leave any trail in the water to speak of. It's like what you would see after a fishtail passes rather than the turbulence created by standard propellers. So he went on to test it. You've probably seen it in big cities. There are these 2 million gallon water tanks, and they've got usually a couple of them next to each other because they store all this water, but it develops into layers of heat that breed bacteria. So they have to throw in a lot of chemicals, and then they have to pump the water from one tank to another one to keep it moving and try to, you know, reduce the bacterial counts. So Jay has one tiny little impeller in the bottom, you know, of these tanks, right? He replaced what they were doing with his little impeller. It's so beautiful. It's in the Museum of Modern Art. It uses the power of 3 light bulbs, and it can purify and keep clean 2 million gallons of water with little to no chemicals whatsoever.
That's perfect. Right?
So this is the kind of true biotechnology and the forefront of what Jay is working on now, and he's got a deal in Beijing in China to actually test this out in a large city there, is that he says that when you think about these water gallon tanks with these thermal layers of heat and, you know, bacteria growing in them, that everything becomes stratified and kind of clogged and stuck, that the atmosphere now with global warming, the greenhouse effect, quite literally, is exactly the same thing. So he's got one of these spiral impellers that he believes can actually arrest global warming and buy us about 10 to 20 years by essentially blending the atmosphere.
Interesting.
So this is what's called geoengineering. I'm sure you've heard about these things. There's
sure
a lot of crazy schemes out there. Most of them are pretty terrifying, and there's no laws. Any billionaire buccaneer could go out there and do whatever the hell they want. I mean, they could blow smoke into the atmosphere like a volcano, and no one could stop them, or throw iron filings in the ocean. That's another thing they want to do.
It's like fracking. There's no laws there either, is there?
No. Well, there should be, and there are some, but pretty minimal. You know, that's because of George W. Bush, and Dick Cheney, actually, is the one who opened the door to all that. But so anyway, Jay, we are moving. You asked about the future. I mean, we're moving into very, very severe, climate situations, and what we need to do is stop the fossil fuels ASAP and start to bring the carbon count down. Pretty quickly, we can, you know, past a certain point, past about 2 degrees centigrade, it probably becomes runaway climate change. And at that point, there's not much anybody can do. But anyway, Jay thinks that these spiral impellers could really do it with pretty minimal disruption, since it's nature's own form and it's what nature does to move energy around.
I would love for us all to have our own system where we're not even on the grid at home. Wouldn't that be great?
Well, I couldn't agree more, and that's a lot of what's coming, because there are these epic moments in nature where these giant shifts happen, often quite quickly. I mean, climate change, we know 8,000 years ago and 11,500 years ago occurred, very dramatic climate change occurred in just a matter of about 10 years, you know, in a decade or two. And we may be approaching those tipping points right now. We're already in the red zone. Last year, this past year, was the hottest year on record. You know, this past March, 15,000 separate local temperature weather records were broken, from temperature highs and lows to the swarms of tornadoes to flooding. So that's what we can expect, is, you know, more and more of this. And what it's going to come down to is what you're describing. It's what we call resilient communities. Because when these fast-forward kind of exclamation points occur, ecologists actually use the technical term regime shift when something like the climate flips, that it's actually a complete change of the ecological regime. And what we're all going to be faced with is how we adapt very, very quickly. And in fact, our infrastructures are not only brittle, but they're actually causing the very problems that will topple them. So we're so not ready on those levels. And it's going to come down to a much more decentralized society. So, you know, right now it's very interesting. The people who are at the forefront of this are the military, the U.S. military. They recognize what's going on with climate. You know, these are operational people. They're reality-based. The military and the insurance industry have to be reality-based. And so what they're looking at now is one hacker could take down the entire electricity grid, right? Take down 4 bridges on the Mississippi River, and New York City is hungry 48 hours later. I mean, this is not only not sustainable, it's totally not resilient. So you really want to have much more localized, decentralized energy systems, and that makes you much more resilient. It's much safer. And when the whole if the whole system crashes, not everything crashes, right?
That's right.
And similarly with food, it's going to be a huge issue of having much, much more localized food systems. So we're doing a whole major thing at the Bioneers Conference this October in California, near San Francisco, a whole day about looking at what makes for a resilient community, what it's going to take to bring down to earth a more localized green economy that actually creates jobs and jobs that are doing the work that needs to be done. One of our colleagues has a place, he's a professor at Oberlin College in Ohio, and they've got probably the leading resilient community project in the country right now. They've made a partnership between the town of Oberlin and the College of Oberlin to have the whole town go carbon neutral by 2020, running completely off fossil fuels, and they've got the actual plan to do it. And then they've got a 20,000-acre eco-agricultural belt, agroforestry, that will be capable of producing about 70% of food for that area, right? All locally, which is a huge driver for the local economy. It's going to create a lot of jobs. And, you know, food, I mean, it involves everything, not just what people think of farmers, but it's processing, manufacturing, marketing, education, distribution. You know, what doesn't food affect? I mean, it's a huge, huge enterprise. So I think, you know, when you talk about being off the grid, we have to look at our communities, because as an individual, you're going to still be very vulnerable. You really, you know, community is where our resilience is going to be.
Well, you sound like you're pretty bullish about the future, Kenny.
I'm more hopeful than I've been in a long time, George, because the denial is finally lifting, and we are moving from breakdown to breakthrough. And everywhere that you look, real life, the real world is being revealed. I think people have an extraordinary opportunity to see how things really work right now. And, you know, from our perspective with Bioneers, the solutions are largely present. We really do know what to do in most cases, and certainly what directions to head in. So it's mostly political and economic issues. And, you know, when you see something like apparently about half the military now sees national security as internal sustainability of the United States, of our food, our energy, our water, you know, these kinds of things. So these are really big changes, you know, and I'm very, very encouraged. And I think what's imminent within the, probably the next 2 to 3 years is we're going to see the equivalent of a wartime mobilization, but this time to actually create sustainability and hopefully peace as well. You know, the world is being shook, and we know we can't go on. I mean, last year, you know, the economics are shifting. The world invested more in the past several years in renewable energy than in fossil fuels. I mean, that's a giant sea change.
That is a huge change.
So that's where it's all going, and I'm extremely encouraged that we're heading in that direction. And, you know, it's a lot's going to come down to how much people want to reclaim democracy in this country, because there are also forces that do not benefit from this shift. And, you know, the fossil fuel industry is going to be dragged kicking and screaming into any of this.
Well, with Kenny Ossible, his website, bioneers.org, it's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Kenny, tell us the story of Star Rover.
Oh, okay. This is a really, this is pretty out there, so you'll have to bear with me.
Hey, this is our show, right?
I'm in the right place for this one.
That's right.
So I fell into this story years ago. You know, I do some work in film also, and I was writing a screenplay about the era of the robber barons, because it was really the genesis of the modern corporate state when these giant companies arose and, you know, bought the Senate and bought Congress and all the rest of it. And they kind of wrote the playbook at that time. And I came across this very unusual story about this gang in California called the California Outlaws, because the Southern Pacific Railroad was known as the Octopus at that time. It was the big monopoly in the West. And whoever controlled the railroads controlled all of commerce.
That's
and
right.
Could charge whatever the traffic would bear. So without going into that whole part of the story, this guy who had gone up against the railroad ended up getting, you know, caught and put in jail, and he was actually innocent of the crime with which he was charged. And this guy, Ed Morrell, who had just been kind of hanging around at that time, he didn't have much going on in his life, helped to break this innocent man out of jail. And they were on the run for quite a while up in the Sierras and, you know, avoiding 3,000 bounty hunters, the biggest manhunt in California history at the time. Of course, finally, they were captured. And because Morrell had gone up against the railroad owned the courts, and so he was pretty much doomed. You know, he was a marked man. And first they threw him into Folsom Prison, where he was subjected to a whole series of grisly tortures, and, you know, actual torture. I mean, they laced him up by his wrists with his hands above his head until his kidneys bled. They threw him in a cell and put chloride of lime in there and then threw water on it, and the corrosive fumes completely choke you and scorch your lungs, and, you know, a whole series of things like this. And then finally, they ended up exporting him over to San Quentin, which is the most murderous jail in the country. I mean, really notorious at that time. And the head warden made it clear that he was a marked man. So what they did is they gave him solitary confinement for life, right? If you can imagine that. So as a boy, Morrell had worked in the coal mines, and he had developed a really powerful ability for visualization. So in this little 4x8 cell, you know, that was his life with no windows and no human contact, he would visualize games of checkers, and he would visualize inventions that he created, a diving suit and all kinds of stuff. So 3 years into this solitary confinement, the warden comes in. They think he knows where guns are hidden for a jailbreak. He doesn't. He can't confess even if he wants to. He hates these people. I mean, he lives for vengeance. And then they tell him what they're going to do, which is to put him in a straitjacket, to force him to tell where these non-existent guns are hidden that he wouldn't know about anyway. And so it's a 4-foot canvas overcoat. This was true. This is all a true story. They laced this thing up, you know, with the guard's boot in your back, so tight that your ribs crack, excruciating beyond imagination. And then they left him there, and it was so excruciating, he just felt like he had 1,000 pins and needles, you know, piercing his body and kind of blacked out. And he went on this journey. The reason that we know about a lot of this is that Jack London, the author, ended up meeting Ed Morrell many years later and wrote a novel, his last novel called The Star Rover, based on Morrell's experiences. So what happened was Morrell basically learned, you know, getting put in and out of the straitjacket, he learned to hypnotize himself. And essentially he claimed that he could separate his consciousness from his body, and he would go what Jack London later called star roving. And he was actually able to describe specific incidents that happened, like on the streets of San Francisco, that he had absolutely no way he could possibly know about. I mean, no way. He had no contact of any kind with the outside world, right? Mm-hmm. And so the warden would come back, and they'd let Morrell out of the jacket, and he'd seem none the worse for wear because he claimed he had left his body and just was essentially in suspended animation. So this battle goes on for a while. Finally, the warden is so frustrated so one other thing I should say.
Well, we're losing you on the phone again here, Kenny. Keep trying. We've only got a few moments to go here before the top of the hour, but I'll have Tom call you back again at the top, okay? But go ahead.
Should I keep going?
Well, it's getting worse.
Oh, gosh. I don't know what it is.
What are you on? Are you on a cordless or landline?
Yeah, it's the only landline here, but I haven't moved at all.
But is it cordless?
Yeah.
Oh, that's the problem.
Okay.
All right, so we've got one more hour to go with you. Kenny, why don't you just stay on hold? I'm going to tell everybody what's in store for the rest of the week here, and we'll have Tom reconnect with you and get you all straightened out for next hour. It's a long distance to Hawaii, but they still have good phones there. I've got a lot of friends there, as you know. On our next Coast to Coast program, James Fox is going to join us for a couple hours, along with Travis Walton. We're going to talk about an incredible case. Colonel John Alexander is going to pop in and join us as well. And then in the second half of the program, split show, we're going to be talking with a associate of the late Dr. John Mack, who, of course, was the expert in alien abductions. That's going to be on our Wednesday show. On Thursday, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe joins us, and she's back from Turkey, where she has an incredible story of Göbekli Tepe in the mysterious 12,000-year-old limestone area. And she spent some time in Turkey. She's back with a series of special reports on that. And then, of course, on Friday, we're going to be talking a little bit about ESP and time traveling. And then, of course, those special Friday night and the Saturday morning open lines here on Coast to Coast AM. If you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. We're going to be back in a moment. We will take your phone calls and your stories. You've heard what we're talking about. We'll be right back.